There's a couple of reasons that we use the term food insecurity when referring to people who might not know where their next meal is coming from. The official reason for this is because it is a technical term. There are degrees of food insecurity, from people who plan weeks ahead to buy staples in bulk because they'll be eating nothing but that near the end of the month, to people who visit food banks or friends' houses or anywhere else just to get a bite to eat, to people who simply go to bed hungry. The unofficial reason is perhaps because when you say that 4 million Canadians are to some degree battling hunger, it's tough to get people to believe that. Hunger, the kind of crippling hunger that makes people sick and unable to concentrate and leaves them begging for handouts, is not something we associate with this country. It feels shameful that in one of the richest nations in the world, we have this kind of problem, which is probably why if you have this problem, you don't want to talk about it. Yet the numbers tell us more than 1 in 10 Canadians have trouble finding enough healthy food to eat. And meanwhile, the Canadian government has helpfully issued a new food guide telling us to eat more fresh vegetables and more proteins, and those are expensive. So we need to ask ourselves, why is it that so many Canadians can't afford the foods their own government tells them to eat? How did that happen? What's being done about it? And why is it getting worse and not better? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings, and this is The Big Story. Rachel Robin is a freelance writer and investigative reporter. Her latest project is for The Walrus. Rachel, can you start by telling me, what does food insecurity look like on the ground to Canadians who struggle with it?
Right. So for this story, I went to Halifax, which is a city that's probably it's suffering a lot with food insecurity. They're struggling a lot with that issue right now. It's got the highest food insecurity rate for any Canadian city at the moment. About 20% of people struggle with food insecurity. So when I was in Halifax, I met with, I went to Glace Bay, which was an area that's really struggling in Nova Scotia. There is a community there that's been gutted by, you know, industry, and mines have closed and various things have happened to the town there. So a lot of people are struggling. And what it looks like is, you know, I tried to focus on people who were working or had been working.
Yeah.
And it's just daily, what are you going to eat? How are you going to feed your kids mostly? So, you know, 1 in 6 children in Canada is apparently food insecure right now. So this is actually a much bigger and secret problem, kind of a secretive problem. So what does it look like? It looks like people just try to sweep it under the rug most of the time, I think. Most people are trying to keep it quiet and to not let anybody see what it looks like. But if you do look at families who are food insecure, you've got people sacrificing food for things like cell phone, cable, home line, internet, you know, all this infrastructure that we need in order to look for work or to be employable,
right?
You know, and food actually is quite far down on the list when you're dealing with, you know, food insecurity. It's usually one of the first things to be sacrificed.
How can we have 4 million Canadians, or even 20% of a huge city like Halifax, which is like not a small number of people in any sense, and we're not having a larger conversation about this issue?
It's a great question. It's a complex issue. It's basically boils down to poverty. It's a poverty issue. So we have 4 million Canadians who are struggling. They're working, or their social assistance isn't quite cutting it. They've got, you know, their job, what they're making in their employment isn't quite cutting it. They're students. The tuition is high. Their rent is high. The price of housing is going up. Price of food is going up. And, you know, if you're working, jobs are like job security is not what it used to be.
Right.
That's how it's slowly happening.
Why aren't people talking about it? You mentioned that they're suffering in secret. There's a whole network of charities and food banks and places that are donated in Toronto. I guess we have Second Harvest, which is an organization that handles food that would otherwise be thrown out. So there's this whole network that exists to combat this problem, and yet people aren't talking about it.
I think it's important to see it as kind of a temporary. People see it as temporary. and there's a lot of shame around it.
Yeah.
So in the example, one of the examples I gave in the story was a woman I called Katsumi. She didn't want her real name used. Her husband wouldn't even meet with me. He didn't want to talk to me. He didn't want me to see him. He got the kids out of the house, and there was just a lot of shame around the issue. And basically, you know, he was trained as an engineer and had worked as an engineer, and he just, you know, had some problems with his work. He left thinking it would be easy to find more work, went through a bunch of interviews, couldn't get a job for whatever reason. 18 months later, they were, you know, their mortgage payments, their phone, everything's just eating away at their food bill, and they're starting to eat from food banks, and they have three small children to support. And when Katsumi was telling me her story, she was in tears and very ashamed of the fact that as a mother, it was so difficult for her to support her children, to feed her children. You know, there's nothing in the cupboard but pasta and that sort of thing. So I think there's a lot of shame around the issue, and people don't want to talk about it, even if they are suffering with it. And they see it as temporary. You know, you can always get $20 from someone to cover, and, you know, maybe I don't have to eat today and my kids will eat. So they find a way that they'll cope and they'll manage.
Is there any more encompassing work than a food bank here and a charity there that's being done? Is this on anyone's radar provincially, federally?
Yeah, I mean, it has been federally for years. We've signed a number of agreements and we've made pledges federally to address the issue of food insecurity.
How do we address it?
It's mostly handled through food banks and social services now. So you're either on EI or you're on welfare, which if you look at the examples in the article, it's those social services don't really cut it anymore. You know, I gave the example of John, who he's in Halifax, and he was 64 years old when I interviewed him. He was on a disability check for having been electrocuted on the job years earlier, and he couldn't function. He couldn't work anymore. So he had $600 a month. That was his disability check. And most of it was eaten up by rent and medication and phone.
Yeah.
And so he had $20 a week to eat. And so our social services just aren't cutting it. Food banks are one. I mean, the people who work in food banks, I spoke to many of them, and they're just the most incredible people.
Yeah.
And they really are providing a lot of social services through those food banks as well. That probably should be provided through social services, but you know, they've become these unbelievable watering holes, I suppose, for people who are hungry and they need a variety of services, mental health or whatever. You know, food banks are great. They're more of a Band-Aid kind of immediate solution. They're not a long-term solution because they don't address the core issue of hunger and why people are hungry. And that's just a lack of income.
So we trail off and figure out what.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, post-war in this country and many others, so-called developed countries, we had something called the welfare state, which was kind of a big deal, and we worked toward that. And it was an idea of building something, building a social safety net. And
yeah, to make sure no one goes hungry here, which is kind of what we think of as a mark of a developed country.
That's right. And it wasn't seen as maybe hunger today. There's kind of this feeling that maybe there's something wrong with that person, or they're deficient in some way, or it's their fault that they're hungry, they're poor. Whereas when these, you know, post-war, when these services were starting to be, you know, developed and talked about, it was more of a, well, this is a lack of income. This is, you know, an interruption in work, something like that. So it was framed a little differently. And then in the 1960s, there was another debate about, you know, how do we feed our nation's hungry in the U.S.? And the U.S., they decided they weren't going to sign any international agreements pledging to federally to feed the hungry, although they do have the food stamp program now in the States. But instead, they decided, you know, it's going to be dealt with at the community level. It's going to be a food bank kind of idea.
Mm-hmm.
And this kind of sprouted up from churches and that sort of thing, where there's always some sort of community charity. So now we have food banking. And as our social services here in Canada didn't quite measure up over the years, we also turned to that U.S. model. Even though we have pledged to provide some, or, you know, come up with some federal policy that will address hunger, and we just haven't done that. We haven't stayed true to that.
What's missing when we rely on charities and the community level to help with this problem instead of federally?
Well, I think food banks, if we're leaving the community to solve it, it's really a matter of whatever the community provides and chooses to provide. Mm-hmm. And it's basically a model based on handouts, right?
Yep.
And so you've got amazing corporate donors, but it's also serving those corporations, you see. So you've got like Hershey's, for example, does this great food program where they give snacks to kids for after school. That's through, I think, the Edmonton Food Bank and probably many others. And if you look at Hershey's, financial statements and their annual reports, and it's very much fits in with their marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, this is a way to distribute Hershey products to children early age, you know, get the brand in front of them. And it's kind of, you know, so we're really leaving it to corporations, to corporate, you know, donations, which may not be the best, most nutritious food. We're leaving it to whatever money the community can give to, you know, organizations like Daily Bread or whatever these incredible charities are. But you're just really leaving it up to handouts and charity. So
it's kind of strange that is happening. And you mentioned that it might not be the most nutritious stuff. At the same time as, meanwhile, the government is actually talking about food in a big way with new Canada food guidelines, which are all about fresh vegetables and protein and all the things your piece so clearly described that people just, there's a huge chasm between the food that people who are poor or who are food insecure can afford and what's on that guideline.
Exactly. And, you know, I think a great example of that is Margaret in the story, who's a cashier at a big food chain, big supermarket chain, and she can barely afford to eat properly. She's had a number of health issues over the years, so she's choosing to eat according to that food guide pretty much. I mean, most of her plate is vegetables, and she's got a lot of yogurt and granola and healthy things that she likes to eat.
Which is not cheap.
It's not cheap. And her lettuce is $4. And I thought, what? And then, you know what? Yeah, lettuce is about $4, mm-hmm. depending on where you buy it and what kind of lettuce you're buying. And it's perishable, and you're going to be buying that every couple of days, or, you know, it's very expensive to eat healthy. So nutritious food is expensive, and it's increasingly becoming a luxury in this country.
How does that play into the stigmatization of people who deal with food insecurity? Because that was another interesting thing you addressed.
Once you're at the level where you're eating out of a food bank, I think people are starting to see you as a charity case, and it's also very time consuming. You have to, you know, with the one family that was that Katsumi's family, and they had three kids, and they had to eat from two different food banks. And so you have to, because you can only get a certain amount of food from each food bank per week, mm-hmm. and or every 2 weeks, whatever the cycle is.
Right.
And so they couldn't afford their car by that point. They couldn't afford gas. So they're TTCing around to different food banks, three kids. I mean, it's very time consuming. It's exhausting. And so, and you know, you don't have time to look for your job, and you don't have time to maybe, you know, or the money to go and make yourself, you know, extremely presentable and whatever. Yeah. So, you know, it snowballs. It becomes a slippery slope. Yeah.
What kinds of costs are associated with this? Because at the same time as I'm sitting here talking to you saying, you know, why isn't the government doing anything to combat this? And why aren't we finding a more comprehensive way to pay to feed the hungry? What is this problem costing us right now? And what would it cost us to fix?
Yeah, I mean, it's like $13 billion annually in like lost productivity and healthcare costs. So, I mean, it's already costing us a lot of money.
What kind of healthcare issues come out of this?
A lot of mental health issues. And, you know, that statistic was a little tricky for me as a journalist because it's hard to tell it's a chicken and egg kind of issue. It's a lot of people who, for example, John, he's on his disability check because of work. He was injured on the job. And so, yes, he has higher healthcare costs in his household. But it wasn't because he was food insecure. His hunger was a product of, you know, his health problem.
Right.
So, you know, but I still think it's kind of the same issue, regardless of how it started, because people who do have health problems that keep them from working, they're not supported effectively enough with our social assistance. It's a huge amount of money. It does need to be on the national radar. I just think there are other problems that people are more concerned about. And because there's so much shame around it and people do tend to hide it, we may not know that, you know, the cashier at our local grocery store is suffering, or the child, you know, a few kids at my kid's school or something are suffering.
That's the big takeaway for me when I finished that piece. And you start thinking that, you know, one out of every handful of people that you interact with a day is not entirely sure where their next meal is coming from. And that's a lot of people. And it makes you think differently about who you're interacting with and what's going on. Almost in the same way that when we talk about the statistics for mental health, you know, that everybody's fighting a battle that you know nothing about. The same kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a hidden problem. And I think it's worth talking about because I suppose you could say, hunger is kind of always been part of the human experience, you know, and it's whether you look at wars or famines and, you know, various reasons that people become hungry, crop failure or whatever. But we're in like the most prosperous, mm-hmm. comfortable, peaceful time in our country's history. And so the question really deserves to be asked, like, why are so many people hungry in this prosperous, developed country where we know what we're supposed to be eating, we know how we want to feed our children and our, you know, our communities? Why are so many people still struggling?
Have you ever been food insecure?
I have, yeah. As a student, I mean, I didn't think of it that way, but when I was learning about food insecurity and the definitions, it's like, yep, I would skip meals. I had to, sacrifice the quality. I became vegetarian, which was kind of trendy, but
it's also cheaper.
It's cheaper. I would have like a muffin for lunch, you know? So that's definitely food insecure by this definition. And starting out as a journalist, I was also food insecure. I was on did a couple of internships and I was working freelance at the beginning. So it was really, it you can definitely, I mean, rent, I think my rent was like more than half of my income as a intern.
And not only in this industry, because we all like to joke about how hard the journalism industry is, but the starving artist is a cliche, right? And people almost frame it as a badge of honor because it's tougher to talk about the fact that you can't afford good meat.
Mm-hmm. And also starving student.
Yeah.
And we're willing to, you know, say, oh, well, that's just part of being a student. But the fact is tuition is too high and rent is too high. And then, you know, if we want to use a personal anecdote, in those student years, I had the most number of cavities that I've ever had in my life. They were all in those 4 years at university.
When I finished my first internship and finally got a job with benefits, I had about 18 cavities filled. Now everybody's going to know that, but I was putting it off.
And I think also just the quality of food that you're eating isn't mm-hmm. as good. You know, you can't afford the fresh vegetables and that sort of thing. Eating a lot of carbs and like simple carbs and muffins and bagels and whatever is cheap. Kraft dinner.
Yes. Well, again, something that's kind of like a badge of honor that we're weirdly proud of, but is also a staple of food insecurity.
Mm-hmm.
Are there any projects, research, campaigns being done that would address this comprehensively as opposed to at the community level?
There's a fantastic organization out of U of T called Proof, and they are pretty much ground zero for any information about food insecurity. They are doing a ton of research. They're pretty much who you'd want to talk to. There's also obviously the many, many organizations that are involved in this. And so places like in Toronto here, Food Share, or in the Daily Bread, you know, any of the larger food organizations, charities would be great places to go for information.
I'll ask you one more question, and this might be the start of a whole other podcast, which we will do someday. But is this the kind of thing when we talk about a basic income from the government? And that's a controversial topic, but is this the kind of thing that that research and that project is meant to address?
Absolutely. And of course, that was shut down. But as I understand it, some of the researchers from Proof were collecting data from that pilot program. Now they have no data at all that they can use because I guess it was shut down right in the middle of the pilot. So, but yeah, the basic income is something that's definitely, it's gotten a lot of traction recently. And it was something that even 5 years ago, I would have said that's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But now it's, you know, as we see this gig economy and insecurity around work as well as food, it does start to make sense. I don't know if giving to a food bank is the solution. I think, honestly, electing someone who's probably going to look at universal basic income seriously, that's the solution.
Thanks, Raisel.
You're welcome.
Raisel Robin, investigative reporter, writer, That was The Big Story. For more from us, find us at thebigstorypodcast.ca or find us at frequencypodcastnetwork.com and on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN and at FrequencyPods on Instagram, on Twitter, and on Facebook. And of course, don't forget to visit us on your podcast app of choice, whether that's Apple or Google or Stitcher or Spotify or Podkicker. We will be there, waiting for your rating, waiting for your review. Thanks for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk tomorrow.